Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 9th of July, these are our main stories. President Trump has given a damning assessment of the current British government and says he will no longer deal with the UK ambassador in Washington. The wealthy US financier, Jeffrey Epstein, has pleaded not guilty to running a network of underage girls for sex. President Macron is sending France's top diplomatic adviser to Iran to look for ways to ease tensions with the United States. Also in this podcast...
2905,
final preparations for a major speed record attempt flying around the globe. Donald Trump has announced that he will no longer deal with the UK's ambassador in Washington, Kim Darroch, following the recent leak of emails written by the diplomat which criticised the president's administration. The US president's tweets came just hours after the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, said she still had full faith in Mr. Darroch. I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Plett-Archer, who told me Mr. Trump had also criticised Mrs. May.
Yeah, some pretty withering comments. He criticized her handling of Brexit. He said it was a real mess. And then he also made no secret of the fact that he thought it was good news that Britain would soon have a new prime minister. And then he did say that he had thoroughly enjoyed his recent state visit to Britain. It had been magnificent, he said, but it was really the Queen who had impressed him most, suggesting that nobody else had.
And this idea that Donald Trump is no longer going to work with the British ambassador, how serious is it? I mean, it's not as if they're not expelling diplomats. It's not like that type of situation that you'd have with the Russians and the Americans in days gone by. So what impact could it have diplomatically?
It's not really clear. As you said, it wouldn't be a formal move. Sir Kim's an accredited diplomat. He's a respected member of the diplomatic community. The State Department hasn't commented throughout, so assume that those relations will continue. But, you know, much of the way that this administration works is through contacts with the White House. And so it's there you'd have to look at how relationships play out. And so far, those relationships had been pretty good. You had quite a few senior Trump officials regularly attending functions at the embassy, parties, private dinners and so on. And they gave very good reviews about the recent visit to the UK. So it's too early to say how that might be impacted.
And briefly, Barbara, this idea of the original leaked emails about the Trump presidency, is that gaining any traction or is that perhaps sort of not seen as anything that his detractors don't think already?
Well, there has been some media coverage of it, of course, but it hasn't dominated the news. And it would be the leak that's the story because, as you said, the content isn't that startling. Mm-hmm. It's those kinds of things that have been reported in the newspapers themselves already. Remember that book, Fire and Fury, yeah. That sort of inside look at the chaos of the White House. This is a sort of diplomatic cables version of it.
Barbara Plett-Archer in Washington. The wealthy American financier, Jeffrey Epstein, has pleaded not guilty to trafficking dozens of underage girls for sex more than a decade ago. He's accused of inviting victims, some as young as 14, to his homes in New York and Florida, where he paid them to perform sex acts and to recruit other young women. At a news conference, the US attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, said it was important to bring the case to court.
This conduct, as alleged, went on for years, and it involved dozens of young girls, some as young as 14 years old at the time that they were allegedly abused. The alleged behavior shocks the conscience. And while the charged conduct is from a number of years ago, it is still profoundly important to the many alleged victims, now young women. They deserve their day in court.
Mr. Epstein could face 45 years in jail. Our correspondent in New York, Neda Torfik, has been following the latest developments. She told us more about Mr. Epstein and the charges he was facing.
Mr. Epstein basically became a wealthy financier here by working with wealthy clients. He was known to socialize with the likes of former President Bill Clinton, President Donald Trump, and Prince Andrew. But for a number of years now, for more than a decade, these allegations have followed him that he was a sexual predator trying to lure underage women. Here in New York, this new indictment alleges that he built a vast network of victims, basically recruiting, they said, young girls to come give him a massage at his mansion in New York and his waterside estate in Palm Beach, Florida. But once there, they said he would ask them to undress, would then proceed to molest them, and then would pay them hundreds of dollars to try to recruit other victims. And they said he also operated the scheme by getting his own employees to schedule these sexual encounters and to target vulnerable women. So here we have prosecutors saying that this conduct was shocking, that when they raided his mansion after he was arrested on Saturday, that they found hundreds of nude photos in his safe in his home, many of which were of underage girls. And here in New York, he has pleaded not guilty. Prosecutors want to hold him basically detained until he gets his trial underway, arguing that he's wealthy, he is a flight risk, he has wealthy connections and international connections. But the judge has just adjourned the detention hearing until Thursday, and until then, he will remain behind bars.
Neda Torfik in New York. President Emmanuel Macron of France is sending a diplomatic adviser to Tehran in an effort to de-escalate tensions between Iran and the US. They've come close to conflict amid very serious differences on a range of highly sensitive issues. Alan Johnston reports.
The mission of the French presidential envoy will be to try to find ways to draw the Iranians and the Americans into negotiations. On Sunday, Iran violated the international nuclear accord by starting to enrich uranium to a higher level than it's allowed. It's now planning more breaches of the deal. Tehran is trying to pressure European states that signed the accord into finding ways to ease the impact of sweeping US economic sanctions.
Alan Johnston. As we heard in the earlier podcast, a former Congolese militia leader has been found guilty by the International Criminal Court of all 18 charges against him. After a trial lasting more than 3 years, Bosco Ntaganga was convicted of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including rape, murder, sexual slavery and recruiting child soldiers. He helped lead the Hema tribe against the Lendu in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo when the atrocities were committed in the early 2000s. Among those recruited were a then 14-year-old, Alan Waikanyi, who spoke to Tim Franks.
One of the morning when I was going to school, a car stopped near me. There was just a child of 14 at that moment, focused on my school and my family. Then I found myself recruited by people I could not really identify, but after I will realize that it was Hema group which were in charge of recruitment. Some of them were already soldiers, and it was like a community soldiers. And the same evening, we found ourselves in the training center. I could see Bosco and other local leaders, local commander of the militia around the training center. And also, I could see other kids, other people were also recruited or by their will or by force like me. I could see them the same day in the training center. And then everything started from there.
So you were recruited at the age of 14. What was the situation that then brought you up close to Bosco Ntaganda?
Yeah, the Bosco Ntaganda, when I was first of all in training center, I used to see him coming, talking to us, explaining to us what was the objective of what we were like going to become. But what brought me close to him and my first time to see him face to face in the context of job or fight, it was when we left the training center for the battlefield. I found myself in the same group of different battalion which were under the leadership of different commander, but all under the coordination of Bosco Ntaganda as the chief of staff in charge of operation. So we went to fight. I could fight for my first time, see Bosco Ntaganda, how he was doing things on the ground, how we were fearing him, how fearing the guy was. And
why did you say? I mean, you were obviously just a child. That must have been scary enough in itself. But why do you say that you were fearing him in particular?
Well, you could see people dying every day for a small reason, simply because, for example, as a child, you spend your time by sleeping in your patrol position, and you fell in the patrol of Bosco Ntaganda if he caught you sleeping, or you lost your gun as a child. You cannot control everything. This is one of the commander who was not giving any pardon to someone.
When you say he wouldn't forgive you, that he was tough like no other when it came to military discipline, what sort of thing did he do?
Shooting for killing, that was one of the principles. This is what I was saying, that they shoot you. And we were experiencing this life every day, that they will report to you, the child of this one or the friend of this one was killed, was targeted today, they killed him. It was like a slogan when they talk about target. Then he store his fear by that. You know very well that when you're fighting with Bosco Ntaganda, for example, you cannot turn your back to the enemy. You cannot run away from the battlefield because himself, he will target you. So we're like living in such a kind of violence of your own commander. And also the way he was behaving vis-a-vis to the enemy. He was a very good commander in terms of fighting with a high level of violence that was giving the trust from the soldiers to this guy. At the same moment, they could fear him because we could see how he was fighting against the enemy, how violent he was on the ground by leading the fight.
That was Alaa Waikanyi. The United Arab Emirates is reducing the number of its troops in Yemen, where years of civil war have killed and wounded many tens of thousands of people. A senior UAE official said his country was shifting from a military-first to a peace-first strategy. He said the scaling back of the Emirati troop presence had been coordinated with allies in the Saudi-led coalition, which backs Yemen's government in its war with the Houthi rebels. Meanwhile, the war in Yemen has had a devastating impact on people there. Food and medicines are in desperately short supply, and the infrastructure in many parts of the country has virtually collapsed. That's allowed diseases like cholera to spread quickly. On Monday, the charity Save the Children said the number of cholera cases so far this year was already more than those recorded in the whole of last year, a total of 440,000 cases. James Menendez spoke to the charity's deputy director in Yemen, Jason Lee, and asked him why there had been so many cases of cholera this year.
First and foremost, you've got large sections of the population have been displaced. You've got over 3 million Yemenis that have had to move because of the conflict. The conflict is now entering the fifth year. You've got depressed social economic conditions, so families don't have money. They don't have access to healthcare, don't have access to water. You've got really, really poor sanitation throughout the country. And if you can imagine, during the conflict, there hasn't been any rehabilitation or any maintenance of any of the sewage or water systems. So all of those combined together, and the fact that you've got a protracted conflict that's still ongoing, you've got large numbers of the population that really don't have the resilience and the capacity to actually essentially hold on for much longer. The longer this conflict goes on, the less and less ability normal Yemenis have on a day-to-day basis to keep going.
It is, though, a dramatic increase, and many of the things that you highlight were true last year. I'm just wondering what it is that has changed between this year and last year, given that conditions were so bad in 2018.
The conditions are, again, worse for another year. The ability for you to actually to keep going is reduced. If you can imagine, you've got families here that are reliant upon one wage earner. And they have been since the start of the conflict. But every year the conflict continues, the less ability the family has to withstand this shock. The longer this chronic pressure is being placed on the health system and communities, the less likely the family has the ability to actually continue.
And is that why so many children are dying? Because their resilience, already weakened, is weakened even further?
Absolutely. And you've got the malnutrition. So unfortunately, there have been many, many documented cases that if a child has malnutrition, they're more vulnerable to, first of all, contracting cholera and other diseases because their immune system is compromised. And secondly, when they do contract cholera, they're three times more likely to actually die from it, because the body's completely weakened.
So what's happened to emergency food supplies? Are they just not getting in, or at least not getting in the quantities needed at the moment?
The difficulty is, I mean, if you look throughout Yemen, the need is so high. And to be honest, no humanitarian actor can actually ever meet 100% of the need. The supplies that are getting in, we're finding it difficult to actually get it to those that need it the most.
And so the only real solution is an end to the conflict, presumably.
Absolutely. If you look at all the impacts that we have, the malnutrition rates, the stretched health system, the emergence of communicable diseases such as cholera, diphtheria, measles, all of that can be linked directly to the conflict. So I think, you know, one of the main messages that we have for Save the Children, I mean, we're apolitical, but we really are stressing that there has to be a negotiated settlement and a peace process that stops the conflict. I mean, it's essentially the fighting that's causing all of these diseases that we see, outbreaks that we see in malnourished and increase in number of malnourished children.
Jason Lee, Deputy Director for Save the Children in Sana'a. An American astronaut is preparing to set a new world record for circumnavigating the world. Colonel Terry Virts, a former commander of the International Space Station and a British pilot, Hamish Harding, will fly in a jet at an average speed of more than 800 kilometres an hour. Richard Hamilton reports.
Is it now with 737 Max?
An online feed from inside the cockpit of the Gulfstream jet as it makes its way to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The One More Orbit mission aims to beat the world record for an aircraft circling the globe via both the North and South Poles. It's to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, as well as the very first circumnavigation of the world by Ferdinand Magellan 500 years ago, which took just under 3 years. This mission hopes to do it in 49 hours and 36 minutes, to beat a previous record set in 2008. The journey of 41,525 kilometres will first take them over the North Pole, with a stop in Kazakhstan to pick up more fuel and a Russian cosmonaut. Further stops will be in Mauritius and Chile. The mission is in collaboration with Carbon Underground, an organisation that attempts to combat climate change. Colonel Virts, an accomplished photographer who's taken hundreds of thousands of images of Earth from space, will film the flight for a documentary. The mission will launch on Tuesday at 09:32 Eastern Time, the exact same time as the liftoff for the historic Apollo 11 flight.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And now, here's something to whet your appetite.
That's me drinking millions of viruses.
Crowd Science is the podcast that takes your questions and turns them into audio adventures.
My question for Crowd Science is, why and when did humans first start cooking food?
It's all fun!
I'm Marnie Chesterton, and each week we put your questions to scientists working at the limits of human knowledge.
I wanted to know how cells, how do they know what to do?
They're yanking on their neighbours, they're pushing on their neighbours.
We also try and demonstrate exactly what they're telling us.
What are the limits of human endurance?
You've just run a marathon and been hit by a car. How are you?
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
So if you'd like to inject a bit more science into that,
just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew it! Amazing!
Deutsche Bank has begun making 18,000 job cuts as part of a radical reorganisation announced on Sunday. Whole teams working at the company's offices in Tokyo, Sydney, Hong Kong and Singapore were told on Monday that their roles had been axed. Share traders in Hong Kong said they were escorted from meetings with personnel officers straight to the lifts without even being allowed to return to their desks. Some London staff were warned their passes would stop working immediately. Mike Johnson asked our business editor, Simon Jack, why Deutsche Bank needed to do this.
This is very significant restructuring. It's also very much overdue. In the 1990s and the 2000s, Deutsche Bank made an attempt to try and gate crash into the Premier League of investment banks, the type Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, people like that. And they tried to do try and be everything to everyone. So they spent heavily on recruiting teams in mergers and acquisitions, in fixed income trading, that's bond trading, in share trading. And they tried to spread themselves, as the chief executive admitted today, much too thin into businesses where they didn't have the scale or the expertise. And actually, these are expensive businesses to be in. And when the financial crisis hit, they were very slow to try and bring their bank back to a sustainable size, and they're paying the price for it now. So it was a massive ambition in the 90s and 2000s. It didn't quite work. And when the financial crisis stuck, they were quite exposed, and they haven't, in that intervening decade, taken the kind of measures that other banks have taken. If you think of RBS, you look at the American banks, they were very quick to get rid of their bad assets and put them in a bad bank. So that's what we're seeing now. Very big job losses, as you say, 20%. I expect the axe to fall slightly harder in London and New York than it does in Germany.
Okay, and who stands to profit now most from Deutsche Bank's retreat, largely out of investment banking?
Well, I've spoken to people at Barclays. That, again, has got a US business and a European business and is, in many ways, the last European investment bank standing. UBS is a Swiss bank, but it's more of a wealth management firm. So Barclays are actually quite excited. They see a real opportunity to snap up some business here. But I think the real victors here are once again going to be the big American banks, the Goldmans, the Morgan Stanleys, the JP Morgans. They have won in this battle. And in many ways, if you look at them, they are Wall Street is arguably more powerful than it has been in recent years and certainly before the financial crisis.
OK, you hinted at this here. You think the Jobs Act is going to fall particularly viciously in London, do you?
We don't know what the breakdown is going to be. They haven't given us those details. But if you look at their cutting 20% of the global workforce across the board, and then you look at the businesses that they're particularly scaling back, the trading of shares, their investment banking division, a lot of that happens in London and New York. So it would make sense for the axe to fall harder in those places than across the board. And if you take 20% of that and you go up from there, you've got 8,000 people, for example, in the UK. Doing that arithmetic, you quite easily get into 1 to 2, possibly more, 1,000 job losses here.
Simon Jack. A light aircraft built by two South African teenagers has landed in Cairo after flying the entire length of the continent. Two young pilots completed the final leg of the northward journey just under a month after setting off from Cape Town. Grant Ferret reports.
The aim of the project, called You Dream Global, is to encourage South African youngsters and others across the continent to believe that the sky's the limit when it comes to ambition. The aircraft was assembled from a kit by 20 teenagers, with a little help from specialists, within a few weeks. Flying it from Cape Town to Cairo took a similar time. One of the young pilots said the difficulties along the way included a shortage of fuel in Ethiopia and a wiring problem with the plane's avionics, which prompted an early landing in Egypt.
Grant Ferret. The 15-year-old tennis sensation Coco Gauff was knocked out of Wimbledon on Monday after captivating crowds with her surprise run. She was beaten in straight sets by the former world number one, Simona Halep. At such a young age, Coco has made headlines around the world. Nuala McGovern spoke to her aunt, Joy Grant, who's in Delray Beach in Florida and who watched the match. So was it a nerve-wracking experience?
Not only is it nerve-wracking, but it's exciting at the same time. For the simple fact that for the love of the game, mm-hmm. you can see that on her face and how she plays. And that is something that our family in general, we speak about embracing love, being kind, being poised. And just to see her do that, it just brings tears of joy to our eyes every time she's on the court.
And what about today? How was it? Because you could see she was getting a little frustrated, I think, at times, even though we're like, wow, it's just amazing you've got that far at such a young age. How is it to watch that? You know, when maybe she misses a point or something like that.
Yeah, I want to tell you, even though the energy was already in the room, I think people were just excited just to see this young girl come and play at the level that she's playing. But watching her play, and if you follow Coco, but knowing her, the same look that she had on her face was a look that she had like years ago. And so internally, I felt that something was different about today. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be honest with you. It was like the comeback kid. There was always hope that was always there. And even though the scores were like they were, she is still a winner.
Joy Grant, the aunt of the tennis player Coco Gauff. And earlier, the world's top women's tennis player, the Australian Ashley Barty, was knocked out by Alison Risker, an American who's ranked 55th. Now, you may not be familiar with Pidgin English, the lingua franca spoken across West Africa. A mix of English, European and local languages, Pidgin has often been considered better suited to the streets than the stage. But in the Nigerian city of Lagos, one woman is trying to change this. An opera written entirely in Pidgin is being performed there for the first time. Our correspondent, Myoni Jones, went to take a look.
An invitation into a different world. Helen Epega, also known as the Venus Bushfires, is singing on the stage of a plush new auditorium in Ikoyi, an upscale neighbourhood of Lagos. She's the creator of Song Queen, which she says is the world's first pidgin opera. The piece is the story of a family of ephorial singers who use their voices to maintain peace in the world. It's a metaphor for our modern society.
These are tough times in the world, really challenging times, and I want to be of service to humankind. I want to be of service to my people. So this is a way for me to bring African culture in a positive way to the world, hopefully uniting Africans and the world.
Some might say that it's quite a provocative act to mix the idea of pidgin, which is considered lowbrow, and opera, that highbrow, together. Are you being deliberately provocative?
Absolutely. I want to start a conversation. I want to say, who makes these choices? And if you do, I'm not asking for your permission.
In Nigeria, pidgin has long been considered the language of the streets. But initiatives like Song Queen show this may be changing. The language is increasingly being used in spaces where you wouldn't have expected it years ago. Students and teachers from a local school in the audience think this is a welcome development.
The perception of pidgin English language before was that it's been spoken by low-class people, especially the uneducated ones, the illiterates. But today, it's acceptable on the radio, on the television.
I think pidgin is a great language. We're all speaking pidgin before the British brought English to us. So I like speaking pidgin. No one wants this life now.
Bringing people together is central to the message and look of the opera. Helen's costume merges influences from around the world. She wears a white kimono with a sash made of printed West African fabric, her braided hair piled high onto a horizontal bamboo stick. And she plays a curious instrument.
We're sitting on stage with the hung, which is a circular metallic instrument. Could you describe it for us?
I've heard it being called a tortoise shell or an inverted steel pan. And it looks like a UFO to me, sort of like a flying saucer. So I say it's my little space baby.
And how do you play it? Can you show me a bit?
So it's a very light touch. So the quicker the release, the better the sound, for example.
Okay, so if I'm trying to... I'm going to try and imitate that.
So, yeah.
It's a lot harder than it looks.
But you're getting some sound, which is amazing.
Lovely. Can you play us a longer piece?
Sure, of course. I can give you a little sequence.
The hung is originally from Switzerland, but it was inspired by the steel drums of Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. This pidgin opera borrows from multiple cultures to promote its message of peace and unity. A message which may sound trite, but in a country that often struggles to reconcile different identities, this celebration of the pidgin language may well be something that can cross divides.
That report by Manny Jones in Nigeria. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Have you ever wanted to speak another language? Whether you want to speak Spanish, French, or German, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons can get you speaking confidently in your new language within weeks. Babbel's spaced repetition method gradually builds your language skills so you intuitively remember what you've learned. No wonder Babbel is the number one selling language learning app in the world. Try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com or download the app. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com. Or download the Babbel app to try for free.